Good. Yeah. So Billy said to us, you know, just we're not setting you any subjects. You can choose what it is that you want to speak on. And so then I suggested that I'd do something on leadership. And then Billy said, well, Dan has also said he'd like to do something on leadership. So we got in touch with each other and it seems kind of fun working together. So we want to ask ourselves a couple of questions. Firstly, in this session, what type of leaders do we need? And then secondly, in the next session, how do we produce and develop those kind of leaders? And I think it is fair to say that each context might require a different style or gift of leadership. You know, it has been said that in a certain, you know, a certain context, if you're in a pioneering context, it requires a certain degree of application. But often those who have established the bridgehead can at times struggle to build on it. You get a little bit of the Churchill during the war scenario and Churchill in peacetime scenario, which my parents, when they were alive, used to talk about a lot. You know, what a wonderful leader he was, led the nation all the way through the war, but once we got into peacetime, really kind of lost his way a bit. And they were quite sad about that because they really admired him. And I think there are different types of leaders that are required in different contexts, but there are some basic qualities that we want to identify that I think will perhaps help us with the task that God's put before us as a network. I think broadly speaking, whichever gifts, abilities, styles, personalities we're looking at, we do need strong leaders, or would I say, qualify that, leaders with strength. Leaders with strength and leaders with courage. I think often you use the term strong leader and it carries a certain unfortunate taste. Perhaps we think more about authoritarianism or a dictatorial approach or leaders who are unilateral in style in terms of the way that they lay out their course. That's it. This is the way we're going. This is what we're going to do. And by saying we need strong leaders, I'm not in any way emphasizing those qualities or lack of qualities, whichever, depending whether you see authoritarianism or dictatorial or unilateral style as strengths or weaknesses. I tend to see them personally as a weakness, but that may be my projection. We're also not creating clones or drones. You know, we're not looking to produce, you know, people that can't think for themselves and people who are, you know, on automatic pilot, you know, run by satellite. We're looking to produce gifts and qualities and then to release those people to reproduce and to see God's kingdom break out in a way that suits both them and their context, but that brings with it a certain consistency of value and direction. So I think there are key areas at this time that we as in, well, probably at all times in the church, these are important areas, but I think for us at the moment that we need leaders who can address these kind of areas. Firstly, there is the area of growth. We need leaders that are about growth, and that's qualitative and quantitative. That's what we need. So it's the kind of leaders that create growth, that create energy. We need leaders who are missional. You know, Christopher Wright says, you know, looking at Scripture, and Scripture is, you know, all it's God's mission, not ours. But he looks at the whole of the purposes of God from Genesis to Revelation and theologically articulates that this, in fact, is God's mission, and that is the mission that we are on. So more than anything, we need missional leaders, leaders who are evangelistic, who have the gospel at their heart. That's vital for this season in the directions we're going. We need leaders who are culturally contextualized. We need indigenous leaders. We need leaders who can reproduce the church in their culture. The church and the Christian gospel is not one that operates in a uniform culture. There's no such thing as a Christian culture. Christianity doesn't require the imposition of a culture or a Sharia law or anything else in order to flourish and to multiply, Christianity incarnates itself in a pluriform fashion. So it's not uniform, it's pluriform. And so we need leaders who are able to enculturate the gospel and the message of the church within their culture, or within the culture that they have been called to. If you're a missional leader, you might come from outside that culture into that culture. That's more difficult. Once you've got your first through converts who come from the culture that you're reaching, it's much easier for them to then go on and reach their culture. But we need leaders that can work with that. We need leaders who can lead in society, seeing that the sphere of the kingdom of God is broader than the church. That's the kind of leadership that we're looking for. Leaders that are comfortable in that kind of framework, leadership that has that kind of mindset. And we were taught about that this morning. Lastly, we need leaders who can renew the church in certain contexts. But if we're talking about a partnership with Methodism, we're talking about renewal, which is a filthy, rotten business, in terms of, getting in there and getting involved. It's not easy. It sounds all lovely and romantic, which it kind of is, but, there's a certain type of leader that renews. There's the Paul is, not on anybody else's foundation. That's what I'm doing. And the renewal leader has a slightly different posture, but needs with equal measure, tact and belligerence. Renewers are both politicians and prophets at the same time. But if we're talking about this Methodist partnership, we're going to need to develop leaders who are also renewers. So, Dan. I don't think I've done that. Areas requiring leadership.
Brilliant. So just want to pause there, as lots we're going to go through. Just want you to have a think about those five areas that Roger's just brought to us. So around key influences for leadership, around growth, mission, culture, society, and then renewal of the church. Just give you a moment, and if you're here with people you know, you can contextualise it yourself. If not, you'll need to set your own context out, but thinking through your area, the sort of leaders that you need within your church, what are some of the keys that need addressing, maybe from those five areas? So growth, mission, culture, society, and renewal. So just going to give you a couple of minutes to spin into little groups where you are. Feel free to move the chairs out the rows if that helps, but just thinking through those lenses, your context, and how we're raising leaders. What are the needs that we've got at this time? Just going to give you a couple of minutes to do that. Okay, we're going to give you one more minute. Okay, friends, should we share our thoughts and learning a little bit? So it'd be great to hear from you. Some of the areas where you feel there's needs, reflecting on those different areas in your context. So any thoughts to be thrown out across the group around what are the needs as we wrestle with those five different lenses of needing to... areas that we need to really master or get a grip on if we're going to influence. Any thoughts? Please go for it. Yeah. Roger's probably better to answer this than me, but I'm happy to have a go.
You're in a multi. I think mission works both. Do you want to say the question?
Right. My name is Yetunde Ibolarian from King's Church in Manchester. My question is this: it's been mentioned this morning by Roger that there is no such thing as a Christian culture. I come from a church where it's very multicultural. So there are different people from different cultures across the world. And as cultures, you know, people have different needs. Some of them are very linked to their cultures. Now, what culture do you then hold up if there is no such thing as a Christian culture? Are you trying to meet the needs of those people or to sort of help them to live out the Christian lives and, you know, put a culture in place, really? So what do you hold up?
Fabulous question. I think that usually mission starts and hits. So you're quite a developed situation. So you're a largest church with different cultures already present within it. Usually when mission starts, it starts to one culture. But if it stays just in that one culture, I feel it stops short of the ideal of the kingdom. So, you know, initially, you know, the gospel started... You know, Pentecost was a Jewish-only event, you know, albeit with a few dispersed Jews speaking different languages. You know, suddenly at Acts 10, the Spirit comes on the Gentiles and messes the whole thing up. You've then got the Paul and Peter's clash, which is, you know, do the Gentiles have to become Jews? Answer, no, they can be Gentiles. And so then suddenly Paul's church has become more and more diverse culturally as they go, starting with Jews and Gentiles, but with all kinds of other stuff. So I think if you are starting, usually good mission starts in a small setting, hitting one culture. But as that church grows, if it's got the seed of the kingdom, you will always have neither Jew, Greek, slave, nor free, or male, nor female at the heart of it. So you would want to create a cult, even though you've maybe started with one culture, you would soon want to create an inclusive scenario. So that then you begin to fragment out and create one, but both. So it's not both and. So in your setting, I would say that you would want to uphold certain values. So you would uphold kingdom values. And around that, there would be that we are one family, we are one framework. And as a community, these are the things that we gather around. You know, we meet all together. We have these certain feasts as families. We share our one kingdom identity. There are certain things we do across the cultures. But within that whole identity, you will have perhaps activities for particular cultural groupings. Now, you have to think... You know, do you do that with your cell groups? Do you have, you know, monocultural cell groups, but cross-cultural big gatherings, or do you have a whole church that's cross-cultural but with individual congregations that are perhaps reaching different language communities, because you might want to have different languages in operation. But if you do that, if you have a congregation or a cell group that's, say, not in English or something, I think when you came together as one meeting, you would want to have full translation. So it's what gatherings, when the church comes together, do you display your unity, so therefore you unite around some core practices that everybody can do, and what areas or gatherings do you reach individual people? Is that gatherings and cells, or do you think, no, small groups, we really want those to be cross-cultural too, so therefore are there other activities that are more based around food or particular needs, with, you know, whether it's educational needs or other needs within particular people groups, whether it's, you know, particular, you know, because I would imagine if you're multicultural, you try and do a marriage course, you know, you're going to have phenomenally different issues from different cultural groupings, perhaps within marriage. I don't know. So I think it's not either or, it's both and so it's working out how do our kingdom values express themselves in our one identity as a church. And there, so what are the areas that we stick together on, and what are the areas that we specialize on, and how do we work those two things together? Because what you want is, because we all know, if you can do something that's, you know, specifically radically targeted at youth or students or, you know, different ethnic cultural groups, there's a way that you can gather them and communicate to them. So I think you want to have that framework going on, but you don't, unless you were forced to, I wouldn't want to, you know, well, we're going to have this cultural congregation here, this cultural congregation here, this congregation, and we never meet together. On the other thing, what we don't want to do is make the whole thing uniform, so actually you lose the distinctiveness. So the Afro-Caribbeans will have to lose their distinctiveness to be part of this. So we want to try and keep in the all together. We want to try and honour and reflect all the different cultural distinctives. I mean, Bruno, you probably do some of this in your congregation, don't we, the way that you use food and all of that kind of stuff. Would you like to share some of that?
Not much to share without putting a lot of thought through, but you know, food stuff is, you know, the idea of bringing that diversity. You know, we got you know, we're not a big church in Chichester, but it's a diversity of cultures. You know, so the Sunday meeting is a kind of uniform, but the diversity around the food. You know, we do something called All Nations, so get people to cook food from their countries of origin. And, you know, then it enables the different cultures, you know, to express themselves, therefore, you know, through that mean.
Because I think the thing is we deify, we've done this as English people. We, you know, we think God's a gentleman and God's this and God plays cricket, you know. And you know, each culture tends to deify certain things of their culture and call it Christian, whereas I think the gospel, it both flows with the culture and heavily critiques each culture. But fabulous question.
I think the thing I'd add into that is just looking at the Christian faith compared with other faiths, and what we see is the gospel transcending cultures, whereas in other faiths it kind of dictates culture. And I think what we're saying is the gospel needs to penetrate through different cultures, because it's the same gospel, but it needs to communicate in different ways into different settings. So it's more other faiths, culture is right at the heart of application, whereas I think within the Christian faith, culture it can work through the culture rather than dictate the culture, I would see. Yeah, so in and across culture. What an amazing question to start with. I don't know, I think we might have peaked too early, bearing in mind we've got two more. another session after this. Are there any other needs or observations spotted out of the opening piece Roger did there that your groups were wrestling with, or observations? Yes.
I think an observation that we were chatting about is, under the banner of missional, we've lost a little bit of the evangelistic edge, because missional is such a accessible banner that within reason everything finds itself in that camp. But yet, in terms of that aspect of those classic words of salvation, I think for us we're seeing that needs to be heightened in terms of its importance, and not just using this lovely phrase missional, which in some ways doesn't mean necessarily the sake of salvation and what we want to see. So I think for us there's a sense of resharpening in terms of that evangelistic thrust.
Brilliant, very good, very good. Anything else? Yes. I'll try and repeat the question. You go for it. So the question was, do we focus on one of those five areas that Roger's pulled out: growth, mission, culture, society, renewal of church, or do we try and go for a broader brushstroke touching on all? Roger might answer different. My take would be, we need to be fully who we're called to be. We need to engage in all spheres. So personally, there might be certain areas that I am more equipped to and hardwired to deal with. But if it goes, obviously no one person can deal in all those areas. So that's where team really comes to the fore, because if we're going to truly engage and impact, then we do need to get in all those places. Anything to add, Rob?
And I think we have some congregations or expressions or missional communities or whatever you call it might start small, might stay smaller. They might have a particular geographical focus, or a particular community focus, or a particular project focus, which probably means that they'll take a shape of that area, and they might not grow beyond that. But one hopes that they will be connected more broadly and network more broadly, so that when life comes up within them that's not quite, it can be sent out and released and multiplied. And I think most churches will start there. If a church is going to become more of a resource church and more of an apostolic community, more of a resourcing and planting community, I think therefore we're talking about developing, you know, Ephesians 4 ministries. And then if we start, at the moment we start getting into that, you end up with the breadth. So
I'm going to move us on. We're going to, if you've got a question didn't get, we'll come to it. Just conscious of time. Thank you, Roger. I had the wonderful opportunity back in January to head off to Dublin with my wife. We had a weekend away, and there's loads. Has anyone been to Dublin before? Give us a little wave. A few of you, okay. Beautiful, beautiful city. Highly recommend going there. And my wife was really, really keen to go visit Kilmarnock Jail, which is on the outskirts of the city. It's a now historic place. It's not a working jail. But all the history that's attached to that, with the uprisings and the revolutions that went on, where that was the place she was desperate to go to. I was keen to go there. I was intrigued by the history, but I was definitely more drawn to the Guinness factory. So we kind of compromised and stood in Kilmarnock Jail for a morning, freezing, walking around, hearing all the history. And then we went to the Guinness factory on the way home. And I'd heard a little bit about Arthur Guinness, who started the Guinness drink, and what's grown into a global brand. Over £2 billion pounds a year comes through the Guinness factory. And I was a little bit aware of his influence in renewal, and certainly his influence of his faith in that. The more I kind of grabbed hold of it as we did this tour of this wonderful place, was he was one of the most amazing faith-driven, Christ-driven social reformers that has been. he grabbed hold of the need in that day, and we talked about culture and contextualizing culture. He grabbed hold in a society that where access to clean water was really a tricky thing to do, where people drank from the same river, the Liffey, that runs through the middle of Dublin, also disposed of all of their waste in the same river they drank from. And without the understanding in that day, scientific understanding around microorganisms and all that sort of thing, people turned to alcohol to stay safe, and gin houses. And they estimated something like 1 in 6 houses in certain parts of the UK, or Ireland as it was at that time, but also in England too, 1 in 6 homes were gin houses. And obviously gin is a very potent alcoholic drink. And in the midst of that, Arthur Guinness got hold of something and realised that actually there's another way of doing these things. And sometimes as Christians we think we can run to a place, but actually culturising and context of that situation was quite incredible, and came up with this drink, Guinness, which was a lot safer. The alcoholic content was a lot lower. It was safer than drinking water. Still to this day, they're wrestling with the potential benefits of drinking Guinness because of all the mineral content that's in it. And one thing that really grabbed me about that I learned on this tour, well, in fact, not on the tour, I did some reading afterwards, was his interaction with faith. And they think that he sat in St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin when Wesley went over to preach. And I didn't realise that this interaction had happened between two incredible men of God. And apparently, so the story has it, Wesley was preaching one of his renowned, famous messages, which was, earn all you can, save all you can, and then give all you can. This was one of Wesley's classic messages that he delivered. And one Sunday morning, he delivered that message before Arthur Guinness had hit the measure of success. And so the story has it. This message came across. Your wealth is evidence of your calling from God. So use the abundance for the good of mankind. Apparently that's what Wesley preached that morning. And here we are 300 plus years later, and we see Guinness with this incredible turnover of £2 billion. It's in pretty much every country on the face of the earth. And the transformation and the reforming of Dublin was all interwoven in that. Now, I could talk about the reformation and the transformation for ages and ages, but this is what we want to land into this session here. Guinness has probably one of the most famous things that Ireland's associated with now. Guinness has four key ingredients that go in to make this world-famous drink. Other people try to make similar stouts, but they don't quite manage it. And the four ingredients are very simple. They are barley, the first and most important of ingredients. There's stories attached to that, that the reason that Guinness has its strong sort of distinctive flavour is to do with the fact that right at the beginning that Arthur Guinness could only afford to buy, there was shortages of barley during the potato famine and all this, that could only afford to buy barley that got burnt, that had been roasted and got burnt. And that apparently is where some of the flavouring and the distinctive colour of Guinness comes from. The foundation of the flavour, they described it. Then there's the hops. They only use female hops. I didn't know there was a male and a female hops, but apparently there is. They only use the fairer sex of hops to bring out this flavour. And then the next ingredient they use is water. Behind Dublin, in the hills, the Wicklow Mountains, they pump water down in, and Guinness actually went and bought some of the lakes in the Wicklow Mountains in order to get this really pure water in. And then finally, the most secret of their ingredients, secretive as in their own blend of it, is the yeast that they use within Guinness. And you go into the factory and they have this safe that kind of sits in there, which this Guinness lives in, and apparently they have secret supplies stashed in case anything ever pollutes their yeast batch, so they've got something to fall back on. Now, I want to apply this into our leadership context, and this is how I want to do it. I'd like us to think, and we're going to go now on a little bit of a journey, looking at what are the critical ingredients that we need to develop in leaders? What are the essential things, four ingredients in Guinness that made this drink that went on and has genuinely transformed society, transformed the Irish economy? What are the key ingredients that we need to be installing and building and developing in other leaders, but also in ourselves? Let's not forget that we need to develop things within ourselves if we hope other people have a chance of developing them as well. So what is it? And then what are the benefits that those things have? What are the knock-on benefits? We don't strive for necessarily, Guinness didn't do it to strive for economic growth or to be on in every continent on the earth. But what are the knock-ons that have? So we're just going to explore five things that we think are critical. Now, this isn't an exhaustive list, but this is just some things that we think are really helpful. Roger.
I think the first thing, I do like this, whether you think you can or can't, you're right, which I think is interesting. I think the first thing that we need entrepreneurial leaders. We could use the word apostolic, we could use the word evangelistic in this context, but it's a type of leader that is going to get out there and is going to make things happen, who's going to think out of the box. And, you know, over the last decades, the church overall has, in the UK, has declined in size. Maybe the last 50 years of renewal and church planting has kind of stemmed the flow in certain contexts. You know, many new churches have emerged. You know, incredible things have happened both inside and outside the institutions. You know, you have St. Miletus at HDB, which is a fairly new training college, training more ordinands than any other college. It's fairly new, and it's part of that whole entrepreneurial can-do framework that we see around Alpha and that kind of thing. More and more, we need leaders that are going to do that. And so as churches, we need to see how we're going to capture people who are coming to Christ, who have that slightly more maverick, slightly more entrepreneurial, slightly more independent, unwilling to fit into our systems approach. And so we need to look at how we get hold of that. If you look at the very nature of Paul, you know, people were quite frightened of him. He was obviously we're starting with the prime apostle, and if we judge everybody by Paul, there isn't a single apostle in the universe, probably. But you know, somebody who it was very difficult to deal with beforehand, who people were quite reluctant to get alongside, who in the end Barnabas managed it, who had a very strong calling of the Lord, which was both mentored in that framework, but he went away and was formed in his own framework by God, who then came back, and, you know, the rest is history. And so it's how do we get hold of these kind of younger leaders, people who have that kind of ability? How do we disciple them, nurture them, send them, release them so that they can take risk? How do we create challenges for them so they can go out and make a certain measure of mess? How do we mentor them? How do we shape them? Because I think it is the entrepreneurial leaders that and we're seeing that on a lot of the stuff that if we're looking at the kingdom of God breaking out in society, you know, it's a lot of entrepreneurial activity, isn't it? You look at Paul, you look at some of the stuff that's been shared, it's entrepreneurial activity. And if you look at the decline of denominations, you look at the decline of churches, it is where the entrepreneur, you know, where the leadership has become primarily pastoral, primarily academic, primarily theological, and, you know, really, as someone once said, a friend of mine who leads an Anglican church, quite influential young leader, the woman that was, you know, recruiting clergy in her diocese came, well, the last thing we need is another type A entrepreneurial leader, you know. And he's sitting there thinking, all these churches are shutting all around him. He's thinking, this is exactly what we need. But often our selection processes weed out these people who are often trouble, you know, often asking the difficult questions, pushing the boat out, You know, coming up with ideas, you know, don't confuse me with another idea. So we have to work how we do that. But entrepreneurial leaders will always be ahead of the game. And when you get the, you know, the apostolic, which is essentially an entrepreneurial type leader with a few other things added, and the prophetic together, you are ahead of the game. You know, 15 years ago, the prophetic operated. You know, my wife Margaret was spoken over prophetically about working with people that are raped and sexually abused. 15 years on, Life Centre, you know, is existed, it matured, it's multiplying nationally. But who would have seen what's happened over the last 2 or 3 years in our culture in that area? But it's 15 years, Life Centre was way ahead of its game in terms of when it started. You know, sexual abuse was an issue that was hush-hush and no one really wanted to talk about. And that was the fight right at the beginning of Life Centre. Now, you know, the media are phoning all the time. You know, it's BBC London, it's BBC Manchester. It's, you know, that's what happens when we release the entrepreneurial. So I think that is something we need to be asking and praying for to actually access our communities to those who are mature in those areas. And also to begin, if you have entrepreneurs who may not be part of your leadership team, get those people to give you some input. And if you're mentoring young people in the faith, you're more pastoral. If you get someone who's a bit entrepreneurial, find someone in business, find someone else who can mentor that young person and begin to shape their mind and their mindset and their attitudes and their skills. Because I think it is that entrepreneurial leadership that's going to see us into the future. Who would have known, you know, some of the movements that have emerged have been phenomenally creative. And I think many young people are growing up within our churches and ending up, you know, in business, in the workplace, this, which is what we want to send them to in the kingdom. But we don't want them to feel that in order to be excessively and extraordinarily creative and pioneering and entrepreneurial, they have to go into business or the arts or whatever. But we want to feel that actually, do you know what? You could be a great church leader and church planter, because that's what we need in many areas. So I think that's a first quality that I would see is really important. Entrepreneurs for the gospel, for the kingdom, take the entrepreneur word out, put apostolic in there, you're not far away, although there's a measure of anointing and calling that goes with it. The second type of leader that we need, and there can be some tension in this, is team leaders. Leaders who will work with diversity and in collaboration. I think this could be a struggle for people that, you know, I think some people are more instinctive in this area, able to operate. Some of you more entrepreneurial out front. People need to be encouraged and trained and mentored in more of a corporate mindset. Otherwise, we end up with the mentality, you know, there's the best type of pioneer is a dead pioneer, you know, in terms of succession and handing on working in team. Because what we've got to do is get these people out of the way because, you know, all the time they're around, we're never going to get anywhere. They've done a great job breaking this thing through, but they can't take it through to the next level. And that's part of mentoring and development too. But this whole area of team that actually together, you know, we can be radically overachieve if we are able to create communities where people collaborate. And so as leaders, maybe a lot of our teaching, which is around educating individuals, should be a little bit more about getting the whole church into this mindset that we are a team, we share a mission, we share a calling, we are out there and we learn and are shaped in the context of flexing our corporate muscle together at being this team that's reaching our community. And so part of that is leaders who have learned to communicate, leaders who have relational skills, leaders who know how to touch people individually, but also how to motivate and build people together. And you can do that with team, aren't you? Because some people are great at inspiring, getting a vision, getting people to turn up. usually the people that then put the systems in place to enable everybody to have a good experience when they volunteer are not those people. You know, often you get people that get people excited, people turn up, they have a disastrous experience when they arrive, so they think, well, I'm never going to volunteer again. And the second time round, they are more and more difficult to motivate. But if you've got the inspirer, but then you've got a team in place, you've got people that look at it so that when people turn up, they have a brilliant experience, they're cared for, they're touchy-feely, they're given a nice cup of coffee, they get out there, there's prayer, there's an experience of God and a thank you afterwards. You know, suddenly you've got the team beginning to work together and we start moving. And I think within that, there is the dynamic of delegation. So it's entrepreneurial leaders that are sensible enough to put people alongside so that you can then create a framework where we realize that delegation, whilst it may be painful and take more time initially, ultimately multiplies you because it's pushing the power down and outwards. I think it's Tom Marshall that said, you know, if you've got one leader who holds the power, how much power is there in the community? But if you have 20, 30 leaders who are all powerful and with the power is shared with one, how much power do you have then? You have a lot more power. And so it's changing that mindset and creating that framework where we have this sense of team and development that's moving forward. Dan, is that you?
Great. So aware of time. Challenges with that? I mean, I like you have sat in seminars like this and thought, well, that's great, yeah, that's really good, but you have no understanding of the context I'm in. The thought of team is just doesn't work, or the thought of entrepreneurialism will get squashed. What challenges, just holler them out or give us a wave, have risen for you so far? Just look at those two things, entrepreneurialism. Yeah, might just let them sit there. Yes. Brilliant. So the partnership of a maturing faith and church, it's still hanging on to the entrepreneurial bit, that they don't drift apart. Yeah, personally too. Great. Really good. Yeah. Anything else? Yes. Brilliant. So using the team dynamic to help us communicate and be most effective, not assuming the person with the idea is the best person
Every
to communicate it.
Their Jerry, as they say.
Crumbs, there we go.
There's always somebody, isn't there?
Well, every... Yeah. I was going to say, every Moses has their Aaron.
Yeah, it's the same thing, isn't it? Yeah. There's always one or two people alongside who say, okay, you know, you look at Mike Pilavarci, you know, he's got more people sweeping up. He's got quite a few sweeping up around him as well. And so that is so important. So important.
I won't repeat those last two illustrations down the microphone.
No.
Great. Okay, we're gonna press on. We're gonna look at a couple of other things that Roger and I feel are really part of getting the right blend of leadership. So Roger's take us through entrepreneurialism and through team. I want to lead us into one, and this is naughty because we're kind of putting two into one here. We want to suggest this: flexibility and faith. What does that look like? What does that mean? And we have deliberately put these things together because we think they're kind of hard to pull apart if you get it right. We want to establish leaders that are full of faith and that are flexible, dynamic, responsive, able to respond in a very quick way and to follow doors and opportunities that open before them. Interwoven a little bit with the entrepreneurial thing, but in a different way. So let's look at flexibility. Well, change, an area of flexibility that's really important. Change is constant. Change is constant. If you try and resist change, you'll find yourself lost and on the periphery of life within sometimes very quickly, but sometimes it would be more of a drift. Change is constant. The things that we've looked at, society is constantly changing. Church is constantly changing. Culture is constantly changing. So therefore, to be flexible, we have to adapt to that. It's here to stay, I heard someone once say. Change is here to stay. It's pointless trying to resist change. It's absolutely pointless. It's a waste of focus and a waste of energy. So we need to be flexible because change is here to stay. Opportunity, a second thing. The favour of God rests upon us, which is nothing that we've earned, as we know. It's by grace. It's through Christ and what he's done for us. But opportunity sits there because the favour of God rests upon us. You'll find yourselves in opportunities, with opportunities opening before you that you didn't deserve, that you didn't go looking for, but they come. And we need to be flexible to grab hold of those things quickly because sometimes they're there for a very small moment. This time of year, if you're anything like our church to do with working in lots of partnerships with local authorities, with the police, with all the statutory agencies, this time of year, February and March, is the time you've got to be really flexible. Because often you'll get a phone call going, we've got some money that's sitting in a budget that needs to kind of go. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to get it next year. And it needs to be spent in this sort of way. Could you help us? You have to be flexible. You have to be ready to move to help that, and equally blessing the community, but blessing your local authority that they can access these grants and things in future. One of our local ministers in the city that I'm from, who's from a more established traditional denomination, when I first met him, he said, look, I look at your sort of type of church and do you know what thing I love the most? And I kind of dreaded what he was going to say because he's from a very traditional Anglo-Catholic background. He said the speed at which churches like yours can respond. And he said, I wish my church was a bit more like that. And he wasn't talking about the church he leads, but the denomination that he's a part of. We recently have had phone calls from one of the housing associations that we're working with saying, this opportunity has arisen. Can you step in? Can you get involved? I need an answer within a week. There's pressure in that. There's challenge in that. But we've got to be flexible. We've got to be able to move. So change, we need to be flexible because of change, because of opportunity. And we've touched on this, and I won't go into it in great detail. But also within culture, the speed at which and the flex of which culture changes. The most growing, most used platform of social media amongst young people nowadays is Snapchat. I don't know if you've ever used it, but basically it fires a picture at you and 5 seconds later it's gone. It's a symptom of the culture that we're in. You get your picture, you see it, or your video, and then it's gone and never to be seen again. Well, maybe it is, but that's a whole other talk. You need to watch that with your safeguarding stuff. And we need to educate our young people in that. Culture is fluid. It moves. We've got to be flexible in order to do that. So that's the flexibility aspect. Faith. Not being limited by what we see. We cannot be people that are limited by what we see, what's tangible. We can't be, because we're called to not just operate in the tangible, but in the intangible, in areas that don't look possible. In our city, we have a cathedral, and we've been looking to place a youth work, and like many cities across the country and towns and villages, all of our statutory youth provision in West Sussex has now gone. There is no such thing as just general youth drop-in places. So as churches, we came together and said, we feel that's something we want to do something about, that young people have nowhere to just kind of go other than a few great groups like Scouts and Cubs and all those sort of things. There's those sort of the Sea Cadets, there's those sort of things there, but somewhere young people can just go and be. So we decided looking for a building. And someone on the team who was looking at that, in Chichester, there's a bell tower that sits next to the cathedral. It's the only freestanding bell tower attached to a cathedral in the country. It's 500 years old. Someone said, that's where we should run our youth drop-in. And I remember laughing at them going, that is listed to the eyeballs. There's no way in the world that that's going to happen. It's just not going to happen. this person saw with greater faith than I. And here we are having launched our youth drop-in daily service in the bell tower. 6 months on, here we are running the thing. Faith needs to be a key part of what we see and what we do. We need to be all things are possible kind of people. Matthew 19:26 says that, doesn't it? Jesus makes a reflection on, by man this isn't possible, my kind of retake of that. By man this isn't possible, but with God all things are possible. We need to be all things are possible kind of people, not limited by what we see. And we want to be breeding expectancy. We want to be breeding an expectancy of the outrageous. Of what beyond what we can see. So in those two things, faith and flexibility, the next thing is this: we want to be builders and growers. Now naturally one of these will appeal to you more than the other. You might be the sort of person that is all about structure and about order and having a plan and working to a plan, working through process, moving on in a good, organized way. You might be more drawn to the second thing, which is kind of, let's just see what happens. Let's get a handful of seed, lob it out there and see what opens. And we'll just go with whatever emerges and whatever develops. You'll probably be more naturally in your leadership pulled into one of these directions above the other. One seemingly slightly more organic, one seemingly slightly more systematic. Builders are purposeful, they're planned, they're in it for the long term. Roger talked a minute ago about Life Centre, 15 years. They've been in it for the long term. Life Centre will be here in 15 years' time. It's been a very purposeful plan that's been there. Growing things, the more organic, it allows space for the things to emerge, a lot more natural. Maybe 24/7 when it was born was a bit more like that, as Pete was saying yesterday, sharing with us. Obviously, builders can go with the flow, and gardeners and growers need to be systematic. So these things are, isn't one or the other, and you, if anyone ever tells you it is, that's just not true. If you tell a farmer that there's no systems in place, the whole thing wouldn't work. If you tell a builder, we've got a building project going on in our house at the minute, they need to be flexible. I just made a word up there. They need to be flexible and adaptable. When they uncover something they don't plan, they've got to work out how to get around that. Even with the greatest plans, it happens. So they are not mutually exclusive. These things need to work together. The first thing to take note, though, around builders and growers is it takes time. Put relevant timescales in place. Things to be built take time. If you were to plant a meadow tomorrow, it isn't going to be there the next day. Even the more organic things take time to come to fruit. We must build and plant with mindful of realistic timescales in place as we go through things. Purposeful. We need to be purposeful, whether you're a grower or a builder. You need to be purposeful with what you want to grow or to build. Ephesians 4:12 says, there's a much longer piece in this which I haven't got time to read out to you. It says, to equip his people for works of service so the body of Christ may be built up. There's a plan, there's a purpose in place so the body of Christ may be built up, an equipping and a thing that goes through so this can be outworked and achieved. We need to use the gifts and the skills of the people that we've got. We need to add and to help growing and building to happen. So the fourth thing, growers and builders. The fifth and final element that we want to suggest to you today, this is not an exhaustive list, but some things that we feel are really critical. And this may sound ridiculously obvious, but leaders need to be people-centered. They need to be people-centered. One of the values, we have five values as a church, and one of our values is people. And often when new people come into the church, they ask about our values, and when they see people being up there, people laugh about it. We get the mickey taken out of us as a church. Surely that's obvious that a church has to have a value of people. You'd be surprised not. And I think we'll all have probably experienced, unfortunately, if you've been around church for a while, churches that proclaim they have a value of people but don't actually put it into practice, or it slips, gets relegated right down to the bottom of the list. The mission's the most important people, and people get sucked in, spat out, trodden on, steamrolled. And it's really important that we create leaders that are people-centered, that are focused around relations, relational. We then have the faith dynamic within that. Why are we people-centered? Well, because of salvation. As we were just being challenged then. Evangelism being put back into mission and grabbing hold of that. We believe in salvation. We believe in creating community. We believe in people walking through the door and feeling welcome and feeling part of something. It's really important. Hospitality, meeting people where they're at. I really love what Pete was saying yesterday about our front door needing to be completely inclusive, but there is more exclusive parts of who we are as well. We need to meet people where they are, and we need to be outreached. Focus. Roger and I went out with a whole group of friends. One of the guys in our church, it was his birthday a few weeks ago, invited us down the pub. There was probably about 30 or 40 people down the pub. And Roger and I ended up sitting at a table with one of the other leaders in the church having a beer. And a few members of the church decided we have a culture of one of the things that probably comes on our church list is a healthy ripping each other to shreds by taking the mickey out of each other. And people, someone came over and said, "Can't you guys help it? You just everywhere you go, you've got to have a leaders' meeting." And Roger, with his sharp mind, quickly turned around and said, "Oh, you may find this hard to believe, but we're friends. We enjoy drinking beer together, and we're not talking anything about the church right now. Well, I think we're talking about football or something far more important than the church in that moment." I didn't mean that. If you're, especially if you're, you can't see my face. If you're listening on the tape, I'm smiling. we're friends. We're friends, and that's what underpins our leadership. And we want to build relationally, not just within the church, but outside the church. We have worked so hard as a church at building relationships with our, particularly with our local police force and our local district council. That continues to be an area that we just work really hard at. Whenever people come, you know, whenever the police recently needed to run some training meetings and their budgets have been so horrendously cut back, listening again the other day, it sounds like they're going to get cut back even further next year. They don't have the budget to train them, to have places where the staff can be trained. We said, come and do it at our place. And when they came and used a room similar to this, we put cakes there, we put drinks there, we put trays of food out. And they were just blown away. Why? Because people are important to us. People are important, and honouring and respecting people is a really important thing. Any reflections on that? It's easy for you to say that, Dan, but... So around those areas of people-focused... builders and growers, and faith and flexibility. Any thoughts before we draw ourselves to close? Yes.
Yes, I have a not really a question. Mm-hmm. Maybe it is. Are you suggesting that, put it another way, what I see here are cultures. So the church needs a culture
context as successful organizations, there are some organizations that don't have the classic entrepreneurial person out front that are led by creatives, but where there's a sense of collaboration. But usually within that framework there is a permission for this creative team to step out, to break the mold, to break the box. So although you don't necessarily have one person out front, you do have everybody's not equal, and there is an impetus. So I think team is great, provided it's not status quo team. And if you're locked in a status quo, what that setting probably needs is for the sort of holy cow of equality to be slain a little bit, so that we can release someone. Yeah.
But again, it's with the
I mean, you can do that, but I think also you. I think I'm a great one that people on your core leadership will need to also be the doers. You know, otherwise, really, your leaders are trustees that are just operating due diligence. So we went through a thing. We said, right, we're not going to have anybody on our core leadership and eldership that's not running and multiplying a serious portfolio because we want them to be an example. So I think in that setting, you've probably got to ask yourself some questions. What is your preferred culture of leadership in the light of the people that you've got? Because you can only build on what you've got. You can't build what you haven't got. But in the light of that, how can you also displace, you know, it's like a bit displacement, isn't it? Things move as a result of displacement. Have you got enough displacement in your context? And it seems to me that might be something you want to look at.
And I don't think the top person needs to be the entrepreneur. I think if your team is courageous enough, you can have those people working in and around, you know. Yes.
It's the same. If you pitch the bar high enough that anyone who is in leadership in the church has got to be totally entrepreneurial, ahead of the game, a team leader, accept challenges and, you know, the portfolio that you just explained, then the church has no leader. So at the end of the day, the people who are leading an awful lot of churches are the people who happen to be there, and the church is, for their benefit or otherwise, a kind of lumbered with people with limitations.
Well, yeah.
And in a sense, that's what the Methodist partnership's all about, isn't it?
And to me, that's where networking comes together. I think one thing we didn't have a chance to say is that I think good leaders are also networkers. And so, you know, if you haven't got somewhere, you haven't got something, you find out where it is, you go and get it. So you resource investigators. We don't have this. Where is this? This is over there. So we'll go get it from there. So I think that's where we cluster together, don't we? As churches even, and try and work out how we mutually resource each other. I think it's when you cluster together as a group of churches to manage your decline, that's not a good thing. I think what we need to do is cluster together as a group of churches to maximise our resources to grow while we've still got them. And so for me, and then it's getting, because I think things do get catalysed. So if you can bring the prophetic in, or the apostolic in, I do believe things can be imparted and released that weren't there before. So I think that's what we've got to look to do. But normally in a small setting, you can find, okay, what is the USP that God's given us? Where has God placed us? How do we build from here?
And team is so important, as we have touched on. You know, no one of us is any of all of those things. You know, it's really important. Yes. I think if I was in a setting like that, and we occasionally do have to do this, just have a bit of a stock take of what we're doing, what's those who are staff members and those who are in full time in the workplace, what is it we're doing, what can we manage, do we need to realign some priorities here and juggle things around a bit. It's something we regularly do, and we've got a fairly broad team. I think that's really important, because otherwise you're treading water, and what that means is you're eventually going to sink.
So it's about releasing time, releasing money. It's about couples, you know, working out their calling, maybe one releasing the other one. Some people even taking a day out. It's about releasing cash in the church to release people to work. It's about thinking creative as to how you can create those spaces. Because and recognizing the seasons, you know. So, you know, we've had a young couple that have come onto our leadership. They're great. We've trained them a lot, but they've just had a baby. The guy's just started a business, you know. They're both leaders, but one of the guys just said, look, take a year off. They're just about to have another child. Take a year off, start your business, we'll review things in a year. We'll have your missus still on the team, please, so you can do the babysitting. And but we've also downsized her portfolio and just said, just deliver this one thing for us, please. And we're mentoring you through this. So it's about recognizing the times and seasons in individuals' life. Also recognizing that actually, usually, your top 80% of your money will come from 20% of your people. We should reverse that. 80% of your work will come from 20% of people. If you want something done, ask a busy person. Because they would, you know, I know that's, we've got to think rhythms of life and sustainability. But sadly, that so it's about maximizing those people, but also getting those people also to mentor some of the other people so that, that we can kind of build capacity. That's where trade is. But we've got to try and build capacity in our people, not so that we can overwork them and et cetera, but so they could, they can realize the joys of fruitfulness and stress. Because that's what the kingdom's all about, isn't it? It's that pearl, you know. Good. We better finish now because we're a little late. Dan.
Yeah, and we are going to pick up in the next session. So if you want to come join us again, we are going to pick up on how do you grow and build these sort of leaders? What are some of the things that we can put in place to really allow that to flourish? So what sort of leadership do we want? We just looked at five different cultures that we want to develop, DNA strands that are in our leadership, not exclusive, just some things that we've thought through. And next we'll look at how do we go about growing those things. Thanks for being with us. Might see you later. If not, have a great time wherever you're off to.